Human Services Finance Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum present. Do I have a motion to move the minutes from March 13, 2018? Representative Zerwas moves the minutes from March 13th. Any additions, corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Minutes are adopted. Next up for today, we have a continuation of the IHP discussion from yesterday. The Minnesota Department of Human Services is here today with presentation and to talk a little bit about NextGen. And with that, take it away.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I'm Marie Zimmerman. I'm the State Medicaid Director at DHS. And again, I have here with me Ms. Peterman. And so you don't have to hear my voice as often. Even on the next presentation, I phoned another friend. So Ms. Julie Marquardt will be joining us at some point as well. So would you like Ms. Peterson to introduce herself to the record?
Yeah, just continue in whatever order you like and take it away.
Okay, great. So thank you again for having us, committee members and Mr. Chair. We really appreciated the opportunity to be able to present both yesterday and today. Really appreciated the feedback and the questions. I'm hoping that we can continue that conversation with the committee. Just as sort of a reminder of where we left off, we went through some history with model, where we're going with IHP 2.0, and then sort of the next phase for next generation IHP. And really, we really tried to get across what IHPs were about. It's really about testing new ways to deliver and pay for healthcare that leads to better health outcomes. We know that we have gaps in our health outcomes for people that are on Medicaid and Minnesota. In fact, we partner with Minnesota Community Measurement to produce a report for us. So we know there are some places that we have gaps in our quality measures of how Medicaid compares to the commercial market, for example, but also in specific subpopulations in certain communities of color, for example. That we've been in a system of fee-for-service, both in the fee-for-service program, but also in our managed care program as well, meaning fee-for-service is the method of payment to providers, but not necessarily with people getting better, since we still have those gaps in those outcomes. Part of the feedback from the community really informed the next generation RFP as a way to sort of bring some of those innovations that providers have been working on to scale that are showing promise in health outcomes. And then also we need to do a better job of engaging the enrollee and improving their experience overall. So those are some of the focuses and sort of the segue into the next gen. So this next slide is really sort of the goals in going into putting out the next generation. It was a request for information, and it was intended to be a framework. And there were some questions the department put out that we were specifically wrestling with, but respondents certainly weren't limited to those questions. And part of that is was building on feedback that we had received from previous RFIs. So yesterday I went through some of the milestones, and we had asked the community questions back in 2016 to sort of think about what the next phases would be. And some of those included things like providers not always knowing who they're accountable for, right? We talked about some of the challenges around having sort of a look back at attribution versus providers knowing sort of upfront who they are accountable for. The overlapping roles between managed care and IHP, both in terms of responsibility for care management, but also in who's sort of producing the savings and sort of sussing out those two different models. The interest in providers in taking on a larger role in care management, and also having an option for smaller providers who cannot take on, you know, a higher level of risk or something that model doesn't work for them. And also addressing the social determinants of health and sort of formalizing partnerships with community organizations and essentially non-medical providers to address other issues that improve health outcomes. So some of that feedback actually was incorporated into the department's IHP 2.0. That was the proposal that the legislature passed last year that we had some savings attached to. And then some of those things we are trying to address in next generation IHP. So we were very impressed and excited about the level of engagement that we got on the request for information on the next gen framework that we put out. We received 74 individual responses from either individuals or organizations and over 400 pages of written feedback. That I don't think we were expecting, so it did take us a little bit longer to get through that. And we did post that and made that available on our public website sometime in early January. As I said, we proposed specific questions in that DHS was sort of struggling with and wrestling with, and we'll talk about a couple of those. But going forward, we also put out a summary of what we thought we heard in the RFI responses from the community, what pieces we thought needed more feedback, that there wasn't necessarily a community consensus on them. So where do we essentially need more discussion and thinking about different options? What pieces possibly could be implemented? And also a proposed timeline that would allow for a phased implementation and continue discussion and capacity building so this can be successful and not all happening at once. So these were sort of the major areas of feedback that the department summarized. And one was regarding both sort of provider choice and the patient-provider relationship, but also this concept of primary care network exclusivity. So most of the responders agreed that the engagement with primary care or whoever that person's primary provider is, it's not always primary care specifically, should be strengthened, and then that's beneficial. There was a lot of sort of some confusion, some concerns, issues raised around the primary care network exclusivity. And really what that was intended to do was be a tool to address a couple of things that have been raised in the past in the IHP model. And what we were originally proposing, and it was actually one of our first questions, and in a couple of our public forums, I think we were quite honest in saying we struggled with this one too. We're not saying that we necessarily think that this is the right solution, but we kind of kept on coming back to it as a tool to potentially solve the problem. So we weren't saying, oh, this should be a goal in itself. We were saying we think this is a mechanism to accomplish these goals. So one of those goals, for example, would be one of the things that I mentioned just previously is this sort of overlapping responsibility between the MCOs and the IHPs, and also sort of the not understanding necessarily or not always agreeing about who's producing those savings and sort of how to suss those things out, for example. So that's one where we said, look, it's clear that there's not community consensus on that one. If there are other options that we could explore to sort of address some of these issues, we are open to that, and we want to continue working with you on that. So that's one where we said, it's clear there's not consensus, and we need to do more work on this one. Another part of that was really thinking about, regardless of who and how the contracting works, that we just need to do a better job of engaging our enrollees and getting them to more actively select. We'll talk about this a little bit in the procurement slide deck, but we have really high rates of default enrollment in managed care, which means that people are not making an active choice. They're not sending us a form. They're not telling us who they want to be enrolled with, so they get defaulted into whoever the plan is. And so we need to do, I think, a better job of providing outreach and sort of support tools to enrollees to figure out what can get them more engaged in making choice and whether or not they want to look at how to choose their provider. Another component was some of the benefit administration. So there was pretty strong support for the single preferred drug list, which is essentially having a common formulary similar to the one that DHS administers now for fee-for-service. This was really an effort to improve both consumer experience and provider experience as well. So if somebody's on Medicaid or Minnesota Care and they're changing from fee-for-service into managed care, they're going from one health plan to another, they don't have to worry about changing the drug that they're on. They can do that, and then we're also not necessarily paying for that transition that has to occur as well. Providers don't necessarily have to learn all of the different rules that the health plans have. So, again, it was really about improving the consumer and provider experience with this proposal. And an added benefit, hopefully, as well, from some of our estimates, we think this will bring in additional savings to the state in the form of additional rebate. This is also something that we've done already in that we have a single preferred drug list for hepatitis C drugs now in our contract. So we kind of started very small with this already, And we are proposing that we would start this in July of 2019. For dental, I want to be very clear that we have a larger dental access problem in the Medicaid program, and we do not think that this proposal was in any way intended to solve that issue. I think we also don't want this proposal to do any harm or to go backwards on any investment that we've already made in our dental program. So that's one where we're kind of saying that one needs continued discussion again. How does this look with the IHPs? Do they want to partner with the IHPs? Can this financial arrangement look similar to how it does for IHPs? So that one, we're sort of saying that's another one that needs additional community conversation. Non-emergency medical transportation, I don't think we assumed anything would change there now and that it would operate similarly that it does today in the fee-for-service in the 7th County Metro, which is the counties administer it and they hold a contract, in order to do that. That it's actually not DHS administering that one, that's the county. On the financial arrangement, a couple of different things came through. One is needing to consider phasing in risk for providers just like we did in the beginning. We felt like we heard that feedback pretty strongly. And also think about and explore options with the community about how to mitigate risk for providers. Also the need to determine what the financial reporting is going to look like, both any changes for managed care, but also new reporting that we would develop for the IHPs as well. And that we would continue to consider and align with what Medicare is doing, both for their alternative payment methodologies and their accountable care organization programs and what they have to do for their macro requirements as well. And another thing that that came through in the feedback was that we need to continue and really sort of amp up our support and technical assistance to the providers if we're going to move forward with this. So opportunities to do modeling, look at data, that type of thing, so providers really would understand if they're ready to do something like this or not. In terms of outcome and quality measures, a lot of the feedback was to continue to keep the measures targeted, that too many will burden the providers and not necessarily produce any better results, because if they're trying to look at too many different measures and trying to do better on them, then that means resources are sort of stretched too far. So we should continue to be targeted is what we feel like we heard. That measures need to include other things like functional status and longer-term health outcomes. That we need to consider the limitations of the quality measures that are collected today and that should be part of the conversation, and that there was strong sort of support universally for measures that start including things that relate to social determinants of health, but those things need to be developed and tested before they are in any way introduced into any type of payment structure. So those are sort of the key pieces of feedback that we heard as part of this process. So next steps moving forward, we would plan to have different community conversations throughout 2018, both on that sort of enrollee engagement, but also the finding other options for the primary care network exclusivity. And some of those things we would maybe try to do even at the beginning of 2018, and that could just come in the form of trying to have enhanced decision tools and information that's available to people. I think another thing that we feel strongly about is that we need to get information directly from enrollees, so whether or not that comes in the form of focus groups or how that might look, that we need to be hearing directly from them as well. That, and I think I mentioned this one already, but the implementation of the preferred drug list then would be in 19. We would have a procurement in 19 beginning January 1 of 2020 for the metro area. And we'll get into this in the next presentation as well, but just as a reminder, we are required under state law since the last statewide competitive bid for PMAC and Minnesota Care was in 2015 for 2016. So we have to procure the entire state for PMAP and Minnesota Care in 2020 by 2021. So what we're trying to do is at least break up the metro area and the non-metro area. And a lot of that is simply because we have 87 counties and they have their own needs and interests. And I think it was a lot of significant work for them, and it was for the department as well, to try and do the whole state at once. So I think we've talked about with this committee in the past of trying to break that up a bit and not do so many counties at once.
Excuse me, Ms. Zimmer. Representative Loeffler has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Zimmerman. On that point, we have actually passed into law in the past that in the 7 county metro area, counties could go on their own. And over half the state's population lives in the metro area, and our needs are very different. And when you've asked the metro counties to come together and say, what are the problems? What should we be working on? It hasn't worked very well. It's been a difficult conversation. It's always scheduled by you with less than 2 weeks' notice, which is really hard to get people together within one county, let alone 7 counties, to get the knowledgeable people at a common location. But then what you find is very, very different priorities and concerns. The people from Carver County, their number one thing is they want the plans to bring specialists into their neighborhood so they don't have to go to, you know, Hennepin or Ramsey or somewhere else to see a specialist. That's not an issue if you're in Hennepin or Ramsey, but you might have issues with related to access to native language speaking providers, on-site interpretation rather than use of telephonic interpretation. I mean, you know, those sorts of things, which are not the same issue for another county. And, you know, and I just really think that if you're saying you want to bring the community voice in and you want to customize to better outcomes, then we need to actually get more specialized and have like communities together. In Greater Minnesota, it might be more sense to have the regional centers together and the deep rural areas, which have different problems with access and other issues together. I'm not sure. I can't speak for Greater Minnesota, but I can say for the metro, I don't think it served us well to have the same standards and the same goals for the entire area, because you end up dropping out some really significant issues, particularly dealing with health disparities. And I think that if we're going to have a new system, to me it has to be totally focused on outcomes, and those outcomes have to be defined by geographic data. Even within the Hennepin County and within the city of Minneapolis, we find different health needs in one part of Minneapolis versus another. And if you really want to solve, you know, our health equity issues and get better health outcomes, it's actually getting more targeted rather than less. So I'd ask that you reconsider that and make that part of your ongoing discussion about how to design the system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler, I think that you raise an excellent point, and I think that having to do this statewide, I think and we will do that later in our presentation, so we're getting a little bit ahead of the procurement presentation, but I think that was a challenge for us to do the entire state at once, and I think the requirement to organize folks by region, although helpful because some of those issues can be the same, you're right, some of them can be different as well. And I don't think we ran into that in 2011 as much, which was the last time we procured the metro area together. We didn't get that same type of feedback, and I think part of that was because we weren't able to necessarily talk to some of those counties separately as part of the statewide procurement because we were trying to do 87 counties at once. And possibly we didn't allow enough time even in advance. I mean, we started in October of 2014 to procure for calendar year 2016. And I think we're even realizing now that we just need to back that up even further in order to accommodate all of that. So I think it's a great point.
And Mr. Chair, I just would say I think one of our discussion items going forward should be about the timing, because I don't think this big a transformation can happen effectively on the time frame that they've outlined. And we want it to be done well. Do it right the first time.
Please continue. I'm sorry, Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, on these next generation IHP, to what degree do we as a state legislature have oversight on this? I can't remember passing or voting or seeing a bill passed on this, or where does the authorization come from?
Thank you, Representative. Legislative oversight and legislative authority, I guess. Question.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gruenhagen, the language passed in the 2010 session, so that was the original authority for IHP. It has been changed a couple of times since then, once in 2013, which I think we highlighted on the slide yesterday, which was an expansion of the program, a couple of smaller tweaks sort of in between in between there. And then last year when the legislature adopted sort of the what we're calling IHP 2.0, which was really the introduction of a population-based payment and really targeted towards those smaller providers that can't enter risk-bearing arrangements. So at sort of multiple times over the years, we have interacted with the legislature, and that statute has been changed.
Mr. Chair,
that's all we had for the IHP presentation. If there are more questions, otherwise we are prepared to start the managed care procurement presentation.
Further questions from members? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm just wondering, what are you bringing forward in legislation this year that we need to consider in terms of this moving forward, and how will we get the additional information that you've over the last couple of days offered to bring to us so we can actually understand how the system's evolving?
Ms. Zimmerman.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, we are not bringing anything forward this year. We had something last year. Now, as part of the discussions going forward and our work with the community and the providers and the legislature as well over the spring, fall, summer, if something changes and we're getting feedback in terms of considering other options for implementation, then we would come back to the legislature with something additional. So we're not necessarily planning that to come forward with any new language for this coming legislature or the session that we're in right now. In terms of the engagement, so one, we will follow up with all the questions that came up yesterday in short order, and we would be more than happy and grateful to meet with members individually and figure out a way to engage the legislature in the feedback process that's going to occur over the next six plus months, and continually.
One of the things that we obviously were looking for when these were rolled out is to try to get a better value and to try to have competition and innovation from different parts of the state. And one of the predictions was that what you would see is an initial savings followed by static pricing and quality, followed by increasing prices. As you kind of wring out the savings initially, the competition and savings aren't linear. That you kind of get you get some benefit from it, and it's short-lived, and then you might see a reduction in benefit or even a loss of competition. How is that going, and what kinds of things are you thinking about to keep that fresh and to also keep the competition there, so that you don't have either static or regressive prices or competition?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question and something that has come up since the beginning of this model. I think we've tried to acknowledge, and the provider community can certainly acknowledge this as well, that a shared savings model, shared savings, shared risk, that we're probably going to see more in the beginning, and some of that's going to plateau over time. So I think that's part of what we were trying to get at with next-gen IHP, is to continue to evolve and change the financial arrangement a bit in order to address that. We may not have gotten it all right, but I think that's the goal, is to try and continue to evolve the financial model, not necessarily to stay in a shared savings environment. Now, we're only 5 years into the program, which sounds like a long time, but in terms of providers building up their capacity, we have providers that are starting new and just getting into this in their first year even now. So I don't know if we haven't seen any evidence of anything related to pricing, you know, or just folks sort of losing interest or not wanting to continue on. I think that they still want that investment, but I do think that the financial model is going to have to continue to evolve, because I do think at some point there's just not going to be any – the financial model is just going to plateau at some point under a shared savings environment. I think we've tried to say that from the very beginning. And I guess I would ask Heather if she has anything to say to that. Okay.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on that, I think as important or perhaps more important than the focus on savings, which I think everyone in the system and around the table thinks is a good thing, but is really improving our quality And we, I heard in your feedback from that people are concerned about new quality measures and go slow about social determinants and you know, we don't want any newer reporting. Well, I'm sorry, we're spending billions of dollars here, and we should have accountability for whether or not we are getting the outcomes we're paying for. And it's really easy to cherry pick a certain part of your population and get a really successful story based on change practice. But if you're only affecting, you know, 5 or 10% of your population and you're ignoring the rest and not encouraging them to come in for well-child checkups and you know, preventative care, you're not doing a service to the rest of the 90% of the population. And I would really want us to have the only measures be measures related to public program enrollees, not so that it can't be hidden amongst how well they do with upper middle class or middle class people with stable lives in their service patient load. And so it would only be focused on the clients that we are paying for, and that we would have really clearly defined as carefully thought out outcomes, health improvement outcomes, and care outcomes as we do on the financial model. And in the material that you put out for public hearing, and I went through it with a lot of really smart people, and, you know, there's almost nothing there on the quality end that anyone can put a handle on. The focus is once again only on dollars, and we're putting too much money into this to not care about the health outcomes as well. For all the populations. And so I really would ask that as you continue to evolve this, that you involve the public health community and the human services community on defining the outcomes here, because they pick up all the people who fall through the cracks in a variety of different ways. And that, too, is a cost burden to this committee.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, I think that's a great point. I just want to make sure that one thing is clarified. In the current IHP program, we are only measuring them on their Medicaid population. We are not comparing them. The thing that I mentioned earlier was just about us knowing, with Minnesota Community Measurement, us knowing sort of that general gap. But as part of this program specifically, we only measure the providers on the Medicaid population. I just wanted to make sure that that was clear, folks. Sorry if that created any confusion.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right. No additional questions, so please proceed.
Okay. Switching gears a little bit, or only slightly, to managed care.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Marcourt.
Mr. Chair, my name is Julie Marcourt. I'm a director in the Healthcare Administration at DHS.
Welcome. Please proceed in whichever way you'd like.
Great. Thank you. Could you mind forwarding the slides? So, Mr. Chair and committee members, I think we plan on covering a couple of different things, which we hope is responsive to the request. For us to come present, and thank you for allowing us to do that. One is sort of the history of managed care in Minnesota, a little bit of federal history, and I promise we will keep that relatively brief and sort of get into more recent events. Some of Minnesota's managed care reform, which we have partnered quite a bit with the legislature on since about 2011, the competitive bidding process and what that looks like. Some of the revised federal Medicaid managed care regulations that just were finalized a couple of years ago, and just some future considerations that we are thinking about in our communications with the community. So Minnesota was actually one of the first. Once again, we are an early adopter in most everything we do in our Medicaid program. We were one of the first states to receive a federal waiver approval for implementing managed care in Medicaid. 1985 is actually the first year that we had managed care, and we had it in for PMAP, and we had it in three counties. I was like 7 years old at that time, so I can't provide any historical context, but possibly other folks here can. And those three counties were Hennepin, Dakota, and Itasca. I made sure to ask that before I came here. So I think that makes Itasca sort of our first county-based purchasing plan. I think they were actually administering the plan at that time. In 1995, we received a waiver to mandate most people into managed care through MCOs and really expanded the number of counties that were participating in managed care over the next decade. So it really wasn't until into sort of the mid-2000s that we really had statewide coverage of managed care. In 1997, even though we had counties operating, was sort of formalizing, I think, in state law around the county-based purchasing option. And today, 80% of our 1.2 million enrollees are served by MCOs, while the remainder, which is primarily people with disabilities, are in fee-for-service. But we also have a number of services that are still paid fee-for-service. So even though some folks are in managed care, some of their services are still paid fee-for-service. So we have 80% of enrollment in managed care, but the expenditures are still about 50-50 of what's paid out fee-for-service and what's paid out through a health plan. So just as maybe a reference point, because I'll give a shout-out to Mr. Greenman, who gave me these numbers in advance, in fiscal year 2017, the total Medicaid budget was $10.8 billion. 54% of that was paid out in fee-for-service, and 46% of that was paid out in managed care payments. Another thing that Minnesota was sort of an early adopter in is managed care for seniors and people with disabilities. We had one of the first in the nation integrated Medicare-Medicaid managed care program for dual eligibles. And not just having Medicare and Medicaid in the same product, but also having long-term services and supports in managed care for seniors. So it was really a ease for the consumer. They have one card for all of their services. Even when Part D came along later, again, all in the same plan. So the consumer doesn't have to worry about the fact that they're in two different programs. It's really provided in one plan and sort of helps align some of the financial incentives as well. For those folks, that's our Minnesota Senior Health Options Program, or MSHO as it's called. For people who want to stay in original Medicare, we have Minnesota Senior Care Plus that they can be in. And so they're still in managed care for their Medicaid services, but they can stay in original Medicare if they want and not get their Medicare through a managed care plan. So that's a choice that's available. Although we have more of our seniors, and now I'm realizing I didn't bring those numbers, but I want to say it's about 30,000 and 12,000. More of our seniors are in the MSHO program. And CMS actually did, I should say HHS, did a longitudinal evaluation of our MSHO program about a year ago, so I will share that, and really came up with some great outcomes that we've gotten from that program in terms of reduced hospitalizations. And so before I rattle off anything else that might not be accurate, I'll make sure to follow up with the committee and get them that report. It was quite a big deal for HHS to do that longitudinal evaluation for our program. Special needs basic care has been in place. That's our managed care product for people with disabilities in 2006. That one does have some plans that have a Medicare, Medicaid integrated product for the people that are dually eligible on that program. It's had a little bit of a harder time for some of the plans to be in that program, Medicare integrated. That's mostly because of what happened on the Medicare rate side several years ago. We have more plans that are coming back into that because CMS has fixed some of those issues. So we kind of saw more integration up front, then that went away based on what CMS is doing with some of the Medicare rates, and now we see more plans coming back into having a Medicare integrated product. SNBC, there was legislation that was passed in 2011 that turned that program into, instead of an opt-in, that it's an opt-out. So there was about 6,000-7,000 people in that program, and now it's grown to about 50,000 people. So people are enrolled first, and then they have their choice to opt out into fee-for-service. And right now, it's about a 50-50 split of people who are choosing to opt out into fee-for-service and people who are staying in managed care. So the procurement cycle history, so in some ways similar as it is today in terms of what's required under state law, was done every 5 years. We have in recent years had some procurements a little bit closer together. The counties that were included in each procurement really was based on more on history of when those folks either came in to managed care. So they're not necessarily geographically together or share similar provider service areas or were contiguous in any way. It just happened to be when they happened to come in to managed care. So we could have had a cycle, for example, that had five counties up in the northwest, you know, part of the state, and then another three counties that were down in the southeast part of the state. So there really wasn't necessarily any rhyme or reason as to why it turned out that way other than when they came in to managed care. So a little bit of the federal history of managed care. Again, Minnesota was early into managed care. It operated under a waiver mostly until 1997. 97 was the passage of the Balanced Budget Act, and really that started to put more rules and consumer protections into place for Medicaid managed care plans, including that clarifying that all procurements are required to be competitive. In 2002, as sort of a result of the Balanced Budget Act in 1997, they promulgated their first set of rules around Medicaid managed care. And then in 2016, which is our most recent, they did pretty much a rewrite of that entire set of regulations. And we are going to touch on what some of those changes are a little bit later in our presentation. I think this is my last piece of history. In 2008, the Office of the Legislative Auditor conducted a financial audit of Minnesota's public health care programs. I want to be clear that managed care was certainly a part of this, but fee-for-service was as well, and that's obviously still on their website, and it is a great reference tool as well. And a couple of their recommendations included detailed financial reporting from the health plans, that DHS should be getting more details from the health plans, that provider reimbursement amounts should be captured by DHS and should be classified as non-public by the legislature, that administrative expenses, that there should be changes to allocation, there should be increased oversight, and more on what costs are allowable under that we can include in rate setting. There was also some changes for county-based purchasing plans, sort of a move towards more having reserve requirements as opposed to relying on county levy authority, but also that ensuring that expenditures had to be limited to healthcare services as well. And then the OLA just raised general concerns about some of the profits that the health plans had experienced over the past 5-6 years preceding this report. So in 2011, both in working the Dayton administration, but also in working with the legislature over the next several years, I don't want to say these all happened in 2011. They certainly did not. Adopted a number of reforms to our managed care, not just procurement, but our rate setting practices, transparency, data collection, a whole host of things. So the 2011 competitive bidding was adopted legislatively in 2011. The governor and the health plans agreed to cap their profits in 2011, the contract that had already been negotiated in advance of the administration coming in to 1% operating margin profit. Governor Dayton issued an executive order on managed care that resulted in a website that required us to post our contracts, have information about enrollment, and a whole host of other things that are included on there today. An annual report that we do on managed care that's a little bit more comprehensive, and also just increased oversight and review of our rate setting process, which some folks might remember was called the Siegel Report at one point in time. In 2011, the legislature also adopted trend limits for managed care, and I think that extended to calendar year 2015. If I'm not correct, I will look that up and correct myself later. Also, we worked with the legislature to adopt enhanced financial reporting and encounter data monitoring. I think most of that happened in 2013, and it might be a little bit later in our presentation. also legislatively administrative cost limitations. So clarifying which things are unallowable costs for the purposes of DHS, including those costs and capitation rate setting. And then also just changes to our rate setting development and practices and also our procurement and our evaluation of our procurement. So in 2011 is when we first started our competitive bidding cycle for managed care. I want to be clear, this was for PMAP and Minnesota Care. So it's what we call our families and children population, but now includes the, and I should say at that time it did as well, I believe the adult expansion population. We are not talking about our program or our managed care products for seniors or people with disabilities. Those are required to be competitively procured, but they do not have a competitive price bid component. And really the primary reason for that is the interaction with Medicare and that kind of drives that process a bit more. That really we should be getting our Medicaid managed care product contracts more in line with how the state does and other state agencies do contracting using competitive price bidding, that we should be getting a better value for taxpayers. And really sort of overlap, reduce any overlap in sort of the administration of the program. In some cases, we had as many as 5 plans operating in one county, and I think we heard very loudly from those counties and even some of the providers in those counties, like that's just too many plans, particularly in areas where there was significant overlap in the provider networks that were available from some of the health plans. And then, again, just general concerns about the health plan profits as well. So in the first competitive bid cycle that we did, which was in 2011, so we conducted it in 2011, and it was for contract year 2012. Most of the RFP was kind of already underway. So what we normally call the technical component, so the operations of the health plan, what their delivery system is going to be, quality, all of those things were kind of already set and kind of similar to the old way that we had done procurement. The new piece was really bringing in the price bid and getting that data and being able to have information to give to the plan so they could bid on the population. The scoring was changed to 50% technical and 50% based on price. The plans were awarded contracts based on their score and so in their overall competitiveness. So who's sort of the best value plan? Their technical plus their price, what's their total score? And that actually in some cases continues even though the components have changed a bit over time. We had some plans that were in the metro area that lost the majority of the metro area, and so there was some change at that time. And I think we had about 80,000 at that time enrollees who transitioned to a new plan based on that. So all of the plans that were in the metro remained at least in one county, but we had 2 plans in particular that were out of most of the counties in the metro area at that time. We also had the U of M conduct an evaluation of that first competitive bid to say, you know, they interviewed the health plans, the counties, and the state, and I forget if anybody else was in there, just to say, this is the first time we did this, how did it work? And really one of the biggest conclusions was, and I think part of this was because the technical component had already been developed, that there was too much weight on price and that we really needed to do a better job of developing the technical component. So that was, I would say that was probably their major conclusion unless Ms. Marquardt can think of another one. Okay. The $1 billion that's in the savings amount here, I want to be very clear, is not just the result of that 2011 competitive bidding, but it's the other managed care reforms that I listed off in the previous slide, a lot of which also was the trend limits that were adopted by the legislature at that time as well. Sort of moving forward into 2013, so some of those managed care reforms that I mentioned, a lot of those we worked in collaboration with the legislature with to pass in 2013. And a lot of those related to unallowable administrative expenses. So, again, things that we cannot include. It doesn't mean that the health plan can't spend money on those things. It just means for the purposes of DHS setting the managed care rates, we cannot include those amounts for the purposes of setting Medicaid capitation rates. Those included things like charitable contribution, ensuring that compensation for any one individual at the health plan cannot be attributed in excess of $200,000, and that's across all of the Medicaid programs, restrictions on marketing, and also penalties as well. And then there was a significant new financial reporting that was adopted that we get on a quarterly basis, and that's what it was called, and that's what it's called today in state law, is the quarterly financial report. And it's really a lot more detail by services, by population, and the list is there in statute, and we'd be happy to provide that to the legislature as well in terms of what that template looks like. It's quite significant. So it's not something where we developed it and we implemented it in 2014 and it just sort of lives. We continue to refine it based on things that we see over time, and so it's sort of a living document, and it is expanded quite a bit.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, how do you verify the self-reported data or information from the plans when they're filling out reports on administrative costs?
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz, the plans are required to reconcile on our financial template their administrative costs to what they report to MDH on their audited financials, and they have to explain any differences in that. So we do it by service category, and then we also reconcile to their financial audits. Now I'm getting my words mixed up. Their financials that they report to MDH that are audited.
I have one more question.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we MDH regularly audits what they self-report on the financial statements.
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz, what the plans are required to submit to MDH, and I believe they have an interagency agreement with Commerce as well, they do regular financial audits on the health plans. So, yes.
And have we found any discrepancies in those audits? Are those reported back to the legislature, the discrepancies or false reporting?
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz, that would be probably a better question for the Department of Health or Commerce.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just a question on the reimbursement rates. I attend a committee of retired and active doctors in the system, and it's kind of a loosely organized committee. But one of their claims is that they're getting about, on average, 27% reimbursement versus their cost, 27% of what their costs are under these reimbursement rates. And the other thing that troubled me a little bit is that some of the smaller providers said that the bigger medical institutions will come to them and say, if you join us, we'll give you a better capitation or reimbursement rate, which makes me think that the plans are favoring certain medical facilities over smaller providers in terms of the reimbursement rate, and they're almost, and I'm not saying this is the right conclusion, but I just was on the farm, and when you stand on a wood pile and you smell a skunk, you figure there's one in there, okay? They're almost, but skunk, you never smell a skunk? No. So it's almost like they're social engineering them into large medical facilities through, the manipulation of the reimbursement rate. That's what it, you know, that's just circumstantial evidence, but just based on the comments from retired and providers, is there any way of checking on that? Do you know do they treat everybody equally, metro, rural, or is there a differentiation in terms of the capitation or reimbursement rate for different providers dependent on their size or their location in the state?
Ms. Zimmerman.
I think Ms. Parker is going to help with that one.
Oh. Thank you. Mr. Chair, there are no requirements for the health plans to pay a certain level of cost. There are no requirements that they have evenly distributed fee schedules, that one provider and the same provider get the same rate. And I would say probably they don't, unlike the fee-for-service payment schedule, which applies to everybody evenly. To your point of how much we pay relative to cost, we don't have a good sense of what providers' actual costs are other than providers who do Medicare cost reporting. Outside of that, I will say from the fee-for-service payment rate that what you're quoting wouldn't surprise me as being accurate, but where the health plans have negotiated and the different levels that they have, how they pay compared to cost, I don't think we have good insight into that.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thanks for that. So if I understand you correctly, under fee-for-service, it's pretty much even across the state to the providers, regardless of size or location, if I understood that correctly.
Ms. Markford.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The base rate for fee-for-service has to apply to the same category of providers and the same types of providers consistently.
Okay.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, but yet on the managed care side, it seems like there's a little bit of cloak of secrecy as far as who's getting what, and in terms of reimbursement, and a larger facility could actually be getting better reimbursement than a small provider, and we could see this actual social engineering going on, which wouldn't be completely impossible since we don't actually know what those rates are.
Ms. Mark.
Not that you agree that that's going on, but that is a possibility is what I'm asking.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that comment. Yeah, I don't know that I can speak to the intent. Managed care organizations definitely have flexibility to negotiate different rates. Those rates, as I think Ms. Zimmerman said, they are proprietary, so they are protected as non-public data. So we can't release, right, health system X gets this much and health system Y gets this much.
Mr. Chair, one more time.
All right.
Well, I just think, members, this has been the bone of contention all along. They're using government money and setting rates, and according to medical providers, social engineering the system with the reimbursement rates, and we don't know what's going on because they claim it's proprietary information. And I think, you know, when we're talking billions of dollars, it seems to me that because it's government money and we're supposed to, I think we have oversight. At times it doesn't seem like it. I think this is something that we've worked on in the past. We try to get inside this black box to see what's going on, but it just seems that we go in circles. And I personally, based on input from smaller providers on the committee I've been with, retired and active, I think they're favoring the larger medical institutions and they're social engineering the smaller ones to join the larger ones. And that puts everybody as an employee rather than an independent professional. And then they can start controlling if, what, and when they give health care. And that is very concerning to me as a legislator and in terms of the health care that providers being manipulated, and also the type of care that's going to be given out.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to pivot back, following up a little bit on some questions that Representative Schultz was asking is when she was talking about how audits are done, et cetera. One of the things that raised my mind is when folks are submitting their audits, are the organizations all submitting them using generally accepted accounting principles? I know that in some areas, in the medical areas, sometimes they don't. They use a different accounting system, which makes it harder to compare apples to apples. And so I was wondering, do you have any idea? Are they usually doing according to GAAP, or are they using the other systems that might be out there?
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fisher, I'm going to get out of my depth really quick because that's probably a better question for the Department of Health and Commerce, but I believe they use the NAIC standards, which is a National Association of Insurance something, rather not my area. We'll say commissioners or something. And that's, I think, the standard that they use for CSCAP, but I think that's we should verify and follow up with that with the Department of Health and Commerce.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's part of the reason I'm asking is because almost every other industry uses CSCAP, and that's what I'm used to using in the county area. And it always gets a little bit funky when we're all used to using generally accepted accounting principles, and you've got this other industry that doesn't. It's hard to get real apples-to-apples answers, and sometimes this is where I get uncomfortable, is because they're using a different system. You're allowed to account for things differently than we would in the normal areas that we use, and as a result, things that might not be allowable under generally accepted accounting principles might be allowed under the principles that they're using or might be accounted for differently, and as a result, it's very hard for us to track back and forth. And that's why I kind of raise this issue, and I have concerns around the fact that they're using a different one versus when they're reporting to GAAP that everybody else is. While accounting can be complicated for people, it gets much more complicated when you don't have a standard system and you're trying to make comparisons.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I kind of wanted to go back to what Representative Grunhagen was talking about. So, Representative Grunhagen, you had me until you said social engineering. But I think your underlying point, I think we absolutely agree on, that there's a real need for transparency here.
Amen.
And I'm so glad that you're talking about that, because this is a message I've been on for a long, long time. And frankly, and everybody knows that I think we should get rid of PMAP altogether, because I don't think it's... We get into all these complicated things that we've been hearing about now for 2 days, and it's because we're trying to take a system that really doesn't work and make it work in some way by, you know, and it's we're into a lot of complication we don't need. But I wanted really to ask about the issue about the rates they pay being proprietary. If you recall, some years ago, we had a lot of discussion on the House floor about the Timberjay case, which was a legal decision that came out that said, and it did not relate directly to healthcare, but it had application in this area, that said that when government contracts to do something that it would normally do itself, that the transparency provisions go with it. So, in other words, you can't say just because a private company is now doing work for government that they can now say that people can't get access to the information, right? You can't shield information. But in this area, that's exactly what happens. And so after that decision, there was some legislation put forward that was temporary to give the plans a temporary reprieve from having to make their information public. To my knowledge, that expired, and nothing else was ever done. So my question is, under what rule or law is that information still proprietary? Is there something, if we, the legislature, decided that we want that to be public, do we have to repeal something? Or is it just that the plans are claiming that it's proprietary? Or, you know, what's the department's position on that?
Ms. Zimmerman.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, and I'm going a little bit from memory here, but I think part of that was individuals requesting that directly from the plan. So DHS is not a party to those contracts between providers and health plans, so we do not hold those contracts. What we do hold, and I just want to clarify, is all of the claims data that we get from the plans and also the financial reporting. So we have in the encounter claims that we receive from the health plans the amount that they paid for that claim to that provider. The legislature in 256B, and actually it was part of that original OLA 2008 report, is classified as non-public data. So it's the data that we hold is classified as non-public in the managed care chapter of medical assistance.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so Ms. Zimmerman, so from that I take it that if somebody wanted to go to the plans and say, give me the data, that there may not, in fact, be any law that protects them from having to turn over the data. That, in fact, under probably under the Timberjay case, they now are legally required to turn over the data. However, they may not do it. It may take a – somebody may have to sue them to get them to do it. But, in fact, as far as their – let me just put it as a question. Are you aware of any rule or law that they could rely on to say, no, it's proprietary, we don't have to turn it over to you, the person asking for it?
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I would never want to pretend to be an attorney because I'm not one, so I couldn't say whether there was a law or not or a rule prohibiting that. But my understanding, I think, is the same as yours, is that's where the conversation was left once that expired, that if a request had been made directly to the health plan, and I have not been told or made aware of any such request, but that doesn't mean that that didn't occur.
So Mr. Chair.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so just to, you know, to the members, I mean, maybe we as a committee, you know, if we want to know what the different plans are paying, say, a dentist in different parts of the state, Representative Grunhagen, maybe we should just ask him.
We can walk hand in hand and do that.
We sure could. Thank you. On that issue anyway. But not if it's social engineering. I'm not going anywhere near that one.
All right. We're going to go to Representative Lunin, and then we'll try to continue some of the behind in the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is actually a lot like Representative Liebling. She did a much more thorough job. My question was to get that data on how the plans are reimbursing. Would that be something we could incorporate into an RFP, or would we do that legislatively? That's what I was going to ask.
Ms. Zimmerman.
Social engineering. Sure. Okay. Trying to think
Ms. Markford.
Mr. Chair, so I do think the question to how to get it would be to change its classification. So the data that we hold, if you're talking about the paid data on their encounter claims, that would require a change in the managed care statute to change that. Otherwise, it's the contract information that the plans and the providers have between them.
All right. Please continue.
I think I captured most everything on this slide. So, Mr. Chair and members, the next step is something that's actually been an ongoing effort for us at the department, but really changes in our rate setting practices. And you can certainly look at those couple of comparisons that are there. Those are sort of the key things. And I'll just highlight a couple of things, one of which is that we're using more current data in order to set the rates. So we're using the most recent and complete 12 months in order to set the rates, and that we are using emerging information, meaning the medical claims that are happening in the current year when we're starting the rate setting process from with the plans in order to evaluate trend for that coming year. And trend, just to clarify, can be a couple of different things. One, it can be changes in price that occur, and it can also be changes in utilization, but also movement to different types of services. So, for example, if we see more movement towards inpatient to outpatient, something like that would be captured in trend. And, of course, we always incorporate legislative changes into our rate setting. Previously, it had been kind of an average of the last 3 years instead of using a more recent year of experience. The other thing we are doing is we are using the encounter claims more frequently in rate setting. And we are up to a pretty high percentage, I want to say 75%. It varies a little bit by service category, but our goal is to get to using four services that are paid on a fee-for-service basis, which is still the majority of the services. 95% of the payments, provider payments that go out from the plans are paid on a fee-for-service basis. So our goal is to get to 100% of using the encounter claims in order to set rates. That we are looking at more of our own experience as it relates to trend. So the trends that we're seeing in our own local area, but also historically in the program, that we're not using national trends. That used to be more the practice, that we were looking at Medicare or other Medicaid programs that are not necessarily relevant to how Minnesota operates. We talked a bit about the detailed financial reporting that we get, and that has certainly helped inform our rate setting process and also really helped us get at digging into more detail on whether or not things are categorized correctly or whether or not we're including things, for example, that are non-covered services that we don't want to be including in rate setting. and that, as we mentioned earlier, that the different data sources are reconciled. So now we didn't have this financial reporting before. How it worked before is the health plans would report aggregate medical expenditures to our contracted actuary in sort of big buckets, inpatient, outpatient, pharmacy, dental, and that was essentially it. Now we're getting things at a much more granular and detailed level for the plans that really allows us to be more accurate in our rate setting for some of those expenditures. So that's some of the changes that we've made. And again, we see this as a sort of continuous improvement project. We don't see this as something that stops at any one point in time. This is something that we're always looking to improve.
Representative Lockwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Zimmerman, you don't discuss in this at all the role of contributions to reserves. And that has become much more of a, I think over the years we see major excessive contributions to reserves some years and other years not, or so reported losses, which I think is an evaluation of how effectively we are at predicting costs and getting the rates in the right framework, and it would be really helpful to get us some information on that. But are you starting to use reserve adequacy more, and look at that more carefully in setting the rates? I don't see anything in here about that. And now that we have plans proposing to take reserves that were generated in Minnesota and transfer them to other entities and other places, it seems to me the accountability of the system is really, and whether or not we're effectively managing our resources is still an issue.
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, that's a great question, and now I wish I had added that to the chart. We do monitor year over year the amount that we allow for in terms of margin, and it's been at least what we have set targeted in the rates has gone down significantly. So I would say over the last couple of years it's been anything from 0.25% to 0.75% or a percent that is allowed for in terms of contribution to reserve. That obviously can be different in a bid setting, so maybe in the next slide we can talk a little bit about when we set the rate versus when the plan set the rates, then they set that amount. We don't do that on their behalf. But in terms of evaluation of the reserve, that's something that the Department of Health and Commerce do. We do not evaluate their reserves at DHS.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't expect you to evaluate across their whole business plan, but I do expect you to evaluate, what is generated from your business, because that really is, in some ways, the best test if we have adequate controls on what they charge to us versus not. I mean, these are big, large, complex organizations, and they can decide what they want to bill to MA versus what they want to bill to their other product lines. And I'm not sure that we have enough oversight of that, but we should at least be paying attention to that. We, up till now, and perhaps going into the future, I hope, only have contracted with nonprofit organizations. But they haven't always acted like nonprofits. We'll just say we've had hearings on that. And but we do need to make sure that our rates are fair. They cover costs, but that they're not excessive in terms of being a better product line than commercial products that they have. And for many years, that was true.
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, maybe just one thing to clarify. We do actually look at the performance in the previous year. Oh, sorry, Loeffler. Sorry, I'm struggling today. We do look at the amount essentially of profit or margin in previous years. I apologize. I didn't mean to imply that we didn't. We rely on Health and Commerce for more of like looking at the reserve requirements and that type of thing. So I apologize to distinguish between those two. We do actually look at and track over the years, and that is used to inform future rate setting.
Thank you.
Maybe to get into the next slide, and then Ms. Marquardt, I think. Maybe I have one more, and then Ms. Marquardt gets to talk and hopefully get people's names right, which apparently I'm struggling with today and yesterday. So a little bit maybe about rate setting and sort of thinking about when DHS sets the rate for something versus when a health plan submits in sort of a competitive price bid environment. So when the state sets the rate, we are setting the rate for the average population. So this can vary by demographics, so age, gender, that type of thing, by geographic location, right? Different costs in different parts of the state, whether somebody's in an institutional or a community setting, that can drive what their costs are, and we have different rate cells for that. But each plan for each one of those populations is paid the same rate for the same person multiplied by their health plan specific risk score. So the risk adjustment that we have that looks at the health status of the population, each plan has their own risk score for their aggregate population that they serve, and that is applied to the rate setting. So DHS does state set rates in a couple of different ways or for programs. We do state set rates for SMBC and seniors. That hasn't changed, and again, I think I mentioned that earlier, we do not have a competitive price bid for those two products. DHS does state set rates for PMAP and Minnesota Care. We had done that prior to 2011 every year before that. So DHS had always set the rates prior to 2011 and prior to competitive price bidding, just to be clear. But we also do it in the years subsequent to the first 2 years of a competitive price bid. So plans submit their competitive price bid. It's based on a particular base year. So, for example, the statewide competitive bid in 2015 was based on calendar year 2014 medical expenses, and we provided all of that data to them. Once you get a couple of years into the contract cycle, that base year is no longer current, right? So then when the department has to rebate, we don't have a rebidding process. The state moves towards a state set rate. And that's something that we've done in 2011 when we did that competitive bid, when we did a smaller one in 2014 in some of the greater Minnesota counties, and then again in the statewide competitive bid. So that's been a practice that we've done in each one of those cycles. So I just want to be clear about that. When plans propose their bid rates, and that only happens during a procurement cycle, it doesn't happen in between. DHS provides what we call a data book to any plan that's eligible to participate as a managed care organization. It's by county, it's by service category, it's by population, and so they bid average rate for each region. Now, some of those rate cell and sort of demographic factors apply for each individual population, but they are the ones setting the average rate for the population, or they are proposing it. So the amounts that we pay to the health plans can vary. So that's probably the biggest difference. They're paid the same for the population when DHS pays the rates. It can vary when they are proposing bid rates, and they're also the one developing it and submitting it. And then the bid rates are also risk adjusted, so that piece is similar between the two. So the next competitive bid that we did was in 2013 for 2014 contract year. It was in 27 counties that were in greater Minnesota, and they weren't necessarily, kind of as I mentioned earlier, this is sort of, I think, the last kind of legacy service area. We had some that were in northern Minnesota, some that were in southern Minnesota, but not all of those counties. So they were kind of spread out, not necessarily contiguous and not necessarily in the same region. And that just happened to be, that was the next procurement, and those counties just happened to be up in their next five-year cycle. So that's sort of what determined that. Also in 2013 is when the requirement for the statewide competitive bid passed for the 87 counties, and Ms. Markert will take over when we start talking about that. I think because of the evaluation that we had from the U of M, we did make some significant changes to the technical components of the RFP. It was the first time we started asking questions about what health plans are doing around healthcare reform and improving quality, and we had a whole set of questions on that that we had never had before. And maybe one thing I'll say about what we had pre-2011 is we had a laundry list of questions that really didn't necessarily try to get at any specific priorities. It was very straightforward questions, and there were like 70 of them that just said things like, how are you going to provide mental health services? Things that were very generic that didn't sort of get at, you know, what are the things that they are going to do to sort of improve the health and sort of the outcomes of the population. Also, because of the SHADAC evaluation, the weight on the score of price changed a bit. So we had 60% on the technical and 40% on price. So we sort of reduced the weight on price in that particular procurement. And then one of the results from that procurement is that that time the plan bids came closer together. So in 2011, we saw them vary a little bit more. In 2014, we saw them come a little bit closer together. So in that instance, we had a best and final offer process where folks got a chance to rebid, and that sort of determined the score and then where people landed in the award, essentially. It was also one of the first times that we awarded multiple counties, multiple rural counties, to a single plan that was not a county-based purchasing plan, and that was UCARE at the time. UCARE became the single plan, I think, in many of the northern counties, but if they're sitting around here, they can correct me, certainly. So that was kind of a summary of the 2014. And now I will say, maybe just getting a little bit in advance of the 2016 and then almost moving all the way forward to the lessons learned, is I think if we had thought a little bit about maybe accepting some of these counties that were in this procurement, these 27, because they just were procured in 2014, and then we were getting right back into procurement again with the statewide competitive bid, and I think that was just a lot for them to handle. I don't want to speak on their behalf, but that's certainly the feedback that they gave us, is we just got these plans, we kind of just got used to them, and now we're doing procurement again. So hindsight is always, you know, 2020, but we probably should have had a better conversation about should we try and get these folks exempted in state law sort of in that year in between. So that's something I certainly wish we had done.
Thanks, Ms. Zimmerman. And I think in the interest of time, I know we do want to cover the next procurement. So if we could, are we going to be covering that, Anna?
Mr. Chair, so let me just look through. We were going to go through the statewide competitive bid a bit and talk about some of the things that might need to, and some of the differences and some of the things that might need to change as part of the federal managed care regulations for the next procurement. So, and then just sort of some future considerations for the next procurement. So that's, if you wanted us to skip ahead to that, we certainly could.
I just want to make sure that we cover that for looking ahead.
Sure.
So maybe if you want to just think about that as we finish up with about 20 minutes to go with material and questions. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and this was before you were here, Ms. Zimmerman, but I just think it's useful for the members to remember how we got to statewide bidding, and that was, it was a proposal brought in by the Department of Human Services, not in a bill. It was brought in as, I think, an amendment. It was only considered, it was brought to the House. The Senate had already, I think, wrapped up their things, and I remember going immediately into the audience and asking both the counties and the health plans if they had been consulted, and they were totally caught off guard and hadn't heard about it. So it's a lesson to us in terms of paying attention to what the implications are of things that come in at the last minute. And as we look at the lessons learned and the changes as you go forward, I think part of the responsibility rests on us as well in terms of us thinking through whether we should be quick in enabling something that we're not quite sure about.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, I think that now when you said that, it actually triggered my memory a little bit, although I wasn't necessarily involved in that. I think that part of the reason was we were required to re-procure the state for transitioning Minnesota Care from a Medicaid 1115 waiver to the basic health plan. I don't necessarily think a lot of conversation happened about, oh, let's just do the whole state for PMAP and Minnesota Care at the same time, but I think that was part of the reason why that we had to, the legislature actually had to give us a reprieve for a year in 2014 because there were procurements that were due, and then do the entire state in 2015. But I agree with you. I don't think there was a lot of conversations about the potential impacts of that. Mr. Chair and committee members, just briefly, this shows up black on my printed slides here, so I'm going to try and look at this one. But This is, and I think this is directly from our forecast. It is the average capitation rate paid for families and children. Just want to be clear, this is not for seniors and this is not for SMBC. And changes in the average capitation rate over time when some of these reforms and competitive bidding began, and seeing that they did have some impact on sort of slowing the growth of the rates that we pay the health plans, and having that sort of plateau a little bit and then steadily decline a little bit more. So just wanted to highlight that, and maybe we'll have Ms. Marquardt quickly review a couple of the things from the statewide competitive bid. We won't go through all the slides. That information is there for members. And then we'll get to the federal and the impacts to the next procurement. If that works for Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'll just quickly go through some of these because I do think I'm going to try to point out the things that are pretty consistent in any procurement, just so everybody kind of has the backdrop of when we undergo a procurement, what do we do, what do we consider, how does this look today? And then that way you all can kind of decide on the things that maybe you want to weigh in on or ask questions about. So definitely this has been an evolving process, how we work with the counties. The last statewide competitive bidding, you will see that we have adjusted. We continue to adjust how much weight do you put on technical score, how much weight do you put on price. The last one was 55% was on the technical score, 45% was on price. And under state law, we have to have at least 30% must be on price. We definitely look for that balance between price and technical. We will continue to do that. We will continue to work with the counties on how do we hit that right balance. So I don't think there's anything on this slide other than to note that we did, the statewide competitive bid did bring in the county mediation, which I am going to talk about. We had county mediation before, and it had been exercised before, not nearly as many counties as we had to deal with after the statewide. We are really working toward transparency in how we procure for the PMAP program. We work with the counties as far in advance as we possibly can to work on really, to Ms. Zimmerman's point, getting to objective questions that are really getting at what are the outcomes we're trying to promote for people on public programs, and to try, to the best of our ability, to get those local interests expressed. So while they respond on a regional basis for price bid, they actually respond, any health plan who is going to respond in a service area actually is responding to questions that come from the counties in that service area. And sometimes they are specific questions from specific counties in that service area. So while there are state questions that apply broadly to anybody that wants to serve any service area, the questions that come from the counties really can reflect very local questions and issues that are important to them and the issues that they've seen and what they want in a health plan when they are working together on better serving public program enrollees.
Thank you, Ms. Markberg. Representative Murphy has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the slide 20, statewide bid results, and the last line that says major plan shifts resulting in 415 enrollees changing plans. I am wondering if you can share with us either now or and when we get into the next procurement what you learned from that, what the department has thought about in terms of how we prepare for that, measure that, whether we include criteria about that to either avoid or prepare for that, because it's a major number and a major number of people, and I have to imagine that there are things that you learned about that in this process that would be useful going forward.
Ms. Marquardt.
Mr. Chair, I thank you for bringing that up because that was, and I do think we are going to get a little bit into that. Some of that was driven by procuring the state all at once, which meant that things were going to change all over versus when we're doing maybe 20-some counties. There's only so much population that could change. I do think that you know, we do need to be thoughtful about how much can we in the counties take on and how much can our enrollees really bear. Anytime you change plans, that creates the potential for an enrollee's care to be disrupted, for their consistency in drug formulary, provider network. So we do have to be extremely thoughtful about what that looks like to an enrollee. And I think some of the things that we've been talking about within the next generation IHP and how we look at that as what can we bring into procurement, what we have found out was those are the things that matter to enrollees. It wasn't always it had to be this health plan or this health plan. It was I really want to keep my provider. And now because the networks are different, I can't keep my provider. Or I'm on this complement of drugs, and if now you tell me I can't have that plan anymore, now my whole complement of drugs has to be reset. And it took me years to get to this balance point. Those are real life problems that we have to address. And it was a lot to work to provide enough information. We had to provide a tremendous amount of data between plans to help accommodate, here's the authorizations for service for people moving from this plan to this plan. There is a lot of logistical data sharing and information that we have to provide to enrollees and to our health plans and to the public about what is going on. And these also happen to happen when a large number of our enrollees are also going through their health care renewal. And there's a great deal of confusion for people when they feel like, I just renewed. I did my application. I got told I was covered. And now they get, well, now you have to switch health plans. And some of them, to them that means, what happened? How did I lose my coverage? And so really being clear of, and maybe better linking those processes, I think long-term, is our goal. That should be a seamless process, that once you're renewed, you're in the program, now you select your health plan. And that should happen together. And unfortunately for public programs, it doesn't. And I think that's a real shame because I do think it's confusing to people.
Representative.
And I know we don't have a lot of time, Mr. Chair. So I will just respond by saying that as you described that, you're describing it from the enrollee perspective, which I think is important. And we should be, we all should be exceptionally mindful of that in terms of what it means for their pocketbooks, what it means for their care. But you're also describing system change and disruption there that also has a cost attached to it. So I imagine that you're trying to quantify that cost and understand what that means in terms of the procurement process itself and the savings versus the costs that come along with that. And I'm not sure how you account for it and solve for it. But in the bidding process, it sure seems to me that there should be some acknowledgement of the cost of that kind of disruption when you're considering the bids that are coming forward and what it means, not just for the enrollees, and we should put that first, but also for the system costs.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. And also, if I could just request two lines up from that on slide 20 for the 445 as listed total program savings, if you could just maybe shoot us an email showing how that's getting carried in the spreadsheet, that would be great. Mm-hmm.
We'll skip forward to the federal managed care regulations and sort of that impact on procurement and managed care in general.
Okay. So skipping ahead to the slide that's titled Revised Federal Managed Care Regulations. So in 2016, CMS finalized new managed care regulations, which really rewrote much of what had been in place prior to that. Important to our process is that there's still a strong emphasis on the requirement that procurements be competitive, meaning that the state has to evaluate and drive toward value and outcomes. And we need to be conducting scoring in a way that is free from conflicts, ensuring that the people that are scoring are not otherwise conflicted in some way that might construe that they may have a vested interest in the outcome. It very much focused on more around the quality of care, required the state to do a lot more monitoring of quality. It definitely strengthened and supported some of the reform delivery efforts, including those around IHP and value-based purchasing. It focused on program integrity, specifically around providers. And it really introduced a more comprehensive look at enrollee protections, their right to grievance, and that there was consistency in if an enrollee wants to grieve an issue, how do they go about that, and how do we make that consistent for them and clear to them about the timelines, when they do it, and how that process works. As I said, there was a lot around provider screening, and we also are charged to provide, which we did receive resources to start to build a beneficiary support system, which really allows people a neutral resource to get assistance in figuring out what the best plan option is for them, based on their needs, on what they want out of this, what's best for them and their families, and that we are providing resources to help them look at their plan options. If the most important thing is the pharmacy benefit, then let's figure out. If it's a network and certain providers, let's help them figure that out. So we are investing now in building that resource, and we will be working with the counties particularly on that. And then it did a lot to strengthen the rate setting process and kind of standardize that and lay that out, which did bring into, for some of us, there were several different payments that we were making that were either outside of the capitation or were made through the managed care organizations through the capitation, but they were not meeting the new federal standard. And then, of course, this is where the IMD, which I know the legislature has been dealing with that issue, this is the provision that kind of sparked that in managed care. So the directed and pass-through payments, I think we do want to talk about, because I think there has been a lot of confusion about these. The pass-through payments were really those that were just made outside of the capitation. We were providing money to the health plans. They, in turn, were turning that money around and paying it to providers. Those are no longer allowed. Payments have to be built into the capitation unless they meet the directed payment. So the directed payment is still inside the capitation. We can direct the level of payment, but CMS put a whole lot of requirements around that. So the state has to be doing it for a stated purpose that is reasonable. The rate still has to be reasonable, and the state has to be monitoring. Are we meeting the outcome we intend to get when we make that directive payment? So it's not to say that they can't be done. It's just they have to be done with quite a lot of rigor around them.
Some of the future considerations, I think we've already discussed quite a bit, but, you know, just sort of the reminder of needing to re-procure the entire state for PMAP and Minnesota Care by 2021. And now I can't remember, and we'll follow up, we actually do have a re-procurement that we have to do both for SMBC and for the seniors population. Those we usually do mostly on a statewide basis, but sometimes we do them by county, and that's just a much smaller population, so there is a preference to do that statewide. We have to think about the eligibility of for-profit plans that may come in and be licensed in the state and want to submit bids for public programs. We have to think about how we're incorporating IHPs into the procurement process, and that's a little bit about the next-gen conversation we had earlier. But also we've tried to find ways to actually incorporate it even in previous procurements. So, for example, if health plans were partnering with IHPs on doing certain activities, in some of our questions, we incorporated that into the scoring, and they got credit for that if they were working with the IHPs. So we have started that a little bit. As Ms. Marquardt mentioned, sort of strengthening any of the conflict of interest and incorporating that into the process and what that might look like in meeting that regulation. And then we've talked about this, you know, quite a bit, and, Representative Murphy and I think Representative Loeffler were both getting at this, but this is really an enrollee sort of engagement issue for us as well, and whether or not they have the right tools, we're doing it at the right time, getting confused with their renewals, kind of all those type of things. So what can we do to sort of better support enrollees in making their decision that they have the information so we're not seeing those high rates of default? Also, continuing to improve how we incorporate outcomes into both all three components. You know, price is kind of lived by itself, but how do we sort of think about price and quality together, not just price by itself and quality as something different? How we evaluate new entrants into a particular procurement versus folks that have been participating in our programs for quite some time, and that's something that I can guarantee we will try and get lots of community feedback about, just like we did for the statewide competitive bid. That was actually the first time we did that, that we actually went out and asked the community questions about what should be in the evaluation. And we just need to be doing more of that, so we're incorporating the community's priorities. And also just thinking about how do we hold our responders and who's ultimately awarded the contracts accountable, right? So, you know, you can have an implementation plan and say, oh, I'm going to do these types of things and have this type of contracting and implement these types of programs. But how do we evaluate that and what's sort of the appropriate carrot and stick to hold that responder accountable? Or what type of information do we need that's more of a readiness review of those type of things during the evaluation process so we feel confident that they're actually going to achieve the things that they put in their response? So those are things that we definitely want to improve and are part of our future considerations for the next procurement.
Well, thank you so much for your presentation. I know it's a lot of material. We will not be meeting tomorrow, so members can catch up on other committees and bills. And with that, members, we are adjourned.